Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 122nd edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Mariana Cruz Gonzalez. She was born in Puerto Rico, which makes her a U.S. citizen and not a New Mainer by definition, but she is also the brand new Assistant Dean of Students for Diversity and Inclusion at USM, which is what brings her to New Mainer Speak today. Thank you so much for being my guest, Mariana.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure on this beautiful December day.
Absolutely.
So you were born in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and are the eldest of four sisters and a large extended family. I wonder what kind of scenes you recall about your early life in Puerto Rico before moving to Massachusetts when you were just 5 years old.
There's always a memory that I return to periodically when I visit family in Puerto Rico. And it's walking home from school and stopping at a convenience store nearby and buying candy. I had maybe 5 cents, 20 cents on me, and I would, you know, buy candy on my way home and then just continue to walk over to our house. What I would do, and this is the memory that I always return to, and this is the, I'll say why in a second, but what I would do was give away my candy. So I would buy it. I would maybe keep one or two, and then I would give away the rest of it to my friends as I was walking home to our house. And the reason why I would return to this all the time is because it really has been sort of symbolic for me in my life. And one of my core values is really generosity and being able to do something for myself, but in that act, give to others as well. And so my parents would always say to me when I got back to the house and I'd have no candy, or I would say to them, like, oh, I gave it all away. They would say, oh, Mariana, but you know, you should keep some for yourself, or, you know, save your money. And I would always, I just remember that was such a treat for me to be able to do, was to just give away this candy.
Share the joy.
Yeah, penny candy. And so that's one memory that I always return to, that, and the feeling of, you know, the heat, walking home in the heat and being tired from a long day of, you know, school. And I would have my heavy bags. They really arm you with books early on in Puerto Rico. And so I remember my heavy bags and just sweating and really looking forward to that moment, that exchange of candy, exchange of pennies and nickels, and then just giving it away. And that was my way of building community, making friends at such a young age. And so that's always been sort of this ongoing childhood memory for me. But I'll share another one, is that we had chickens in the back of our house. And so part of what I would do was, you know, come home, take my bag off. I was going to say take my coat off, but it's not different.
Wrong end of the...
Yeah, take my bag off and, you know, and then run out into the back and sit with the chickens in the backyard. And so that was another. And so that sort of ritual of coming home, leaving school, walking home, buying the candy, handing it out, and then going and playing with the chickens, for me was... you know, what makes for me a memory of living in the Caribbean, living in Puerto Rico when I was a child.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Beyond sharing the joy, there's a piece of freedom there. You were no more than five, correct?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So you were a little girl.
Yeah.
And you were walking home alone?
Yes.
And empowered with some coin in your
yes.
pocket?
Yes.
And then you could do what you wanted. That's really powerful.
It is. And that gives you a sense of the community as well, the sense of safety, the sense of protection and trust that my parents had, that I had, and that the community had, that you could just walk. I could walk home at five by myself, stop by candy and hand it out, and then keep going home.
Well, that brings us to your parents.
Yes,
your parents
absolutely.
Were hugely engaged in the political movements of the time. Thus, you lived in a world steeped in an independence revolution and in feminism. And I wondered if you could tell us more about your lovely parents and their lives, which set the tone in your home.
Yeah, so my parents were they were married at a young age, and at a young age they were politicized as well, and involved in all kinds of community engagement, community sort of leadership, and really island politics around status for Puerto Rico, particularly involved in the independence movement. My father, a musician, was playing with a band that was very visible throughout the island and even in Latin America and throughout the Caribbean, and playing music that contributed to that political movement around independence in Puerto Rico. But they were married at a young age, and they were, you know, involved in so many kinds of things. And so that led to divorce at a young age as well, which is what brought us, my sisters and my mother and I, to Massachusetts. But my upbringing, you know, the focus there for me has been having this political dimension and this arts-based, musically, specifically musically-based dimension of how to be political and how to express your political ideologies and your political beliefs, on the one hand, through my father's influence. And then through my mother, it's raising us as a single mother. It's working hard to receive the education that she needed in order to be able to gain employment in the way that she needed to raise us. And so I saw that the both threads in my life, you know, sort of weaving my own identity, that political, ideological thread of it, and then that sort of feminist moving forward and doing what you have to do to survive. And that's what brought us to Amherst, Massachusetts. And I think that it, for me, one of the ways that I think about it is when I'm really struggling with something, I return to my core values and I think, okay, so if one of my core values is generosity, if one of my core values is activism and justice, you know, because I grew up with this and it's ingrained and embedded in my psyche, and one of my core values is fighting and for what you know, you want to achieve and not being afraid of struggle, then I have what it takes to move forward and to do what I need to do. And then I get out of my own sort of, I get unstuck if I'm feeling stuck. And I go back. And that really is something that I gained from my parents, as you described, my lovely parents, right? Mm-hmm. And so their own sort of independent lives, independent of each other, but really, in many ways, together have created for me a really strong sense of identity that is political, that is feminist, that is mobile as well, because that, you know, as you know, migration stories are about mobility. And so my mother's mobility specifically influenced also that way for me to think about survival and what I need to do. Mobility is part of that survival story for me.
Mm-hmm. And courage.
You absolutely
don't just leave a Caribbean island and head to Amherst, Massachusetts with three children, five and under, without a fair amount of courage.
At the age of 26.
Yes, mm-hmm. A young woman herself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Puerto Rico has a long history of colonization from the early 1500s and slavery and identity struggles over the years. People born there are U.S. citizens, but not that many Americans realize that at this point. Can you tell us how Puerto Ricans think of mainlanders and how mainlanders think of Puerto Ricans and your experience at living in both places and seeing both directions?
That is a great question, and that is something I think about often because I move back and forth between the island so continuously, so seamlessly in many ways. And in others, I'm navigating perceptions. So growing up, my cousins, my extended family or friends from the island had this idea that in the United States, in Massachusetts, we had everything we needed, and it was all available, and it was all really high quality, and it was in abundance. And the idea of abundance is really one that is, I tie it to this colonized colonial mentality that you know, that the colonizing force is the provider, and that's where the abundance lives. So I grew up with that idea, you know, that I was always sort of countering and, you know, with my family and with people on the island saying, no, we're actually really struggling. And, you know, there's, you know, it's not what you think, you know, what it is in the United States, you know. But it's a narrative that gets reproduced on the island, that everything that comes from the U.S. is better, is bigger, and that there's more of it. And so it's sort of this pull of come move to the island, I mean, to the United States, come become a state of the United States. It's going to be better that way. And so there's a perception there that everything that comes up from the U.S., you know, might or can or should be, you know, for in some ways better. That's one. And then the flip side of that is coming to the United States, or the perception of the United States, is that you have to give up your language, you have to give up your culture, you have to give up, you know, too much in order to be able to survive and thrive in the United States. That the assimilationist discourse and pressure is such that I've encountered many people on the island who say, I will never leave my island, even if I'm struggling here, even if it's so, you know, so-called better in the States. I don't want to give up
and
sacrifice, give up who I am, what I stand for, and what I do. So there's that tension. There's always that ongoing tension, and I've always had to navigate that growing up. Now, the flip side, you know, of that in terms of the U.S., Massachusetts, Maine, and the questions that I get asked about Puerto Rico, or the perceptions that are expressed to me about the island, is I get a range. I mean, I've gotten everything from, you know, oh, I didn't know that you were U.S. citizens. I didn't know that the dollar is the currency.
Don't need a passport.
Don't need a passport. I mean, I get, you know, the range that covers that side. And then I get the other range, which is the other sort of side of that, which is I've been to Puerto Rico 10 times. I'm curious, and I want to learn more about the independence movement, or I want to learn more about what statehood would imply for Puerto Rico, for the United States, and the people who really know a lot about that. And then everything in between. There's a lot of miseducation. There's a lot of no education. You know, what happens on the island doesn't make it in the national news, for example, in the United States, or not CNN doesn't report on, you know, very much at all on Puerto Rico. We don't have any sort of public conversations in the United States about the U.S. territories as a whole.
All the territories. I've been asking people I know, did anyone ever say the words Puerto Rico to you when you were in school at any point? In mm-hmm. geography, in Spanish mm-hmm. class, in history class, and really the answer for people, middle-aged people, is no.
No. And so there's that opens up the space for a lot of miscommunication, a lot of ignorance, but also a lot of curiosity. I mean, I'm always welcoming questions about Puerto Rico. And I always say, like, no question, you know, is simplistic enough, or there's no such thing as a dumb question. Just ask me. And I say, you know, and, you know, people have asked me, like, you know, do you live, are there villages? And, you know, what does that look like in terms of the housing? And so I'm happy to answer any question at any point, because that's part of my project, is to educate about Puerto Rico.
And there's this fabulous tool called Google Earth.
Yes.
You can look for yourself. I do it every week. That's how I know it's so easy to do. Just put in a village, take a look at the pictures, get a sense for better questions to ask.
That's right.
You are listening to WMPG, and if you're just joining us, welcome. This is New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Mariana Cruz Gonzalez, who is USM's brand new Assistant Dean of Students for Diversity and Inclusion. Let's talk about your job a little bit. What brings you here, and why is it important to have a Dean of Students for Diversity and Inclusion on a college campus in Maine?
I think that in 2016, going now into 2017, I think that all colleges and universities of all sizes, of all rankings, of all financial states, and of all student, you know, regardless of demographics, should have an office, a division, an area that focuses on diversity and inclusion. I think that USM's creation of this position and my role is part of, you know, that larger conversation that is increasingly happening in higher education around not just diversity in terms of recruiting diverse students from diverse backgrounds, but that question of inclusion. What does it mean to build community across difference, across identities, and across experiences and backgrounds? And so I think that role is a critical one, because the person in these roles, the people in these roles, are tasked with thinking about this from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., right? And in the evenings and weekends, too, many times. So you have somebody in place at an institution of higher education that focuses on these things and asks these questions from an HR perspective, from a recruitment and admissions and enrollment and retention perspective, from student activities and programs perspective, from a residential perspective. And so it's really critical to be able to have dedicated professionals asking the questions, thinking, doing the strategic thinking, implementing, developing, and delivering programming strategies, policies that focus on, again, not just the diversity recruitment piece, which is critical, but the inclusion. That second part is really critical to my work, the inclusion piece. And so this is why it's important, because demographics are changing. And for the better, I think, you know. Sometimes I hear this, the demographics are changing as a sort of an alarm, you know, like, oh, no. But I don't think it's panic. I don't think it's a crisis. I think it's a really wonderful thing.
Makes a stronger, wider, more stable base.
Absolutely. But what that means is that we got to look differently at college climate and culture, how we've been doing things versus how we can do them. In more inclusive ways. And so this is why it's important. I mean, I could talk about this for another hour. It's not just about demographics. It's about becoming global citizens, you know, and leaving the institutions, graduating from our institutions, being able to engage people from all backgrounds, that represent all areas of the world. And infusing that into the curriculum, into the co-curricular offerings of an institution, is a critical job and a critical component that diversity professionals really do.
It was not that long ago that women weren't part of the curriculum. They were burning their diplomas because they had PhDs that didn't include half of all the people's histories in them.
That's right.
And you're kind of doing the same thing. You're leading this movement toward making sure that we're hearing for all the stories.
That's right.
Not just some of the stories.
That's right.
And then who feels comfortable and safe learning if there's not a place for their voice?
That's right.
And then we don't get that benefit if it's not safe enough.
That's right. Exactly.
And there's a lot of talk about not just starting college, but finishing college. And so I imagine people who feel comfortable in an institution like USM would be much more likely to stay and finish those degrees and get to give their full gifts to the world.
That's an important component of it, is the retention piece. That's right. That's right.
So what kinds of racism have you personally experienced in Maine, Mariana, and in New England over the years?
So I have a funny relationship to Maine, in that I have been coming to Maine since I was young, when I was living in Massachusetts. And I would come to Maine through my dad's wife's family to visit them. She's a Mainer, and I would always remember, you know, thinking, wow, Maine is this, like, not just super homogenous place, but this place of these, you know, grand rocky shores, and this beautiful landscape and beautiful houses, big houses. We used to stay at my dad's wife's family have a home in Booth Bay Harbor, a summer camp in Booth Bay Harbor, and it would be these amazingly beautiful homes, and they were just they are just a lovely family. But I would always think, wow, this is never for me. I will always be a visitor. When I first moved, then I moved to Maine, and I remember being really cautious and really defensive, thinking, I'm not going to belong here. I'm not going to belong here. This is never going to be my home. I'm still going to be a visitor in this area that, in my childhood sort of mind, I created this narrative about Maine being sort of this untouchable place. So I moved here a couple of years ago for the first time, and then I left Maine, and then I came back again a few months ago. And I've been, the lens has shifted, and the way in which I see myself as a member of the community has shifted. But it doesn't mean that I still don't get treated as an outsider, as somebody that is just passing by, as a visitor. And I get questions like, you know, also, when will you go back to Puerto Rico? Like the idea that I'll return eventually. And I get questions about, well, you know, you work at USC. My partner and I now live in Portland. And I get questions like, well, you know, how did you get here? You know, like, how did you get, you know, we have this nice place in downtown Portland, right? And how did you get here? You know, and so those are subtle forms of racism, of microaggressions, really, that are grounded in assumptions that I sort of snuck in, kind of thing, you know. I kind of, you know, against all odds, sort of, you know, found myself in the place that I find myself in now, professionally, personally, and whatever. So for me, it's like this idea of, like, you know, will I ever belong? That question of belonging, will I ever belong in Maine? I see myself as belonging in New England, but not in Massachusetts, and maybe even not in Maine, even though I live here, right? And I don't know, but I feel myself more as a New Englander than a specific, and I identify more as a New Englander than with any specific place in New England, even though I've spent the majority of my life living in Massachusetts and then now in Maine.
That's so quite interesting, because, you know, you're not an immigrant because you're Puerto Rican.
Right.
On the other hand, you're from a Caribbean island.
That's right.
And you have two homes, which is very much like many of the stories that I capture here, trying to find home.
That's right.
Having two homes. You go back to Puerto Rico a lot and keep that flavor as part of your,
that's right,
your stew. And I imagine that's difficult to balance.
Yeah, and I identify when I give workshops, I say, you know, I'm a Puerto Rican New Englander. But again, you know, so the question about the racism, it's been subtle. It's been sort of covert. And it's just this continuous assumption that I'm passing by, I sort of snuck in, I'm just here by accident, and that it wasn't an intentional move, that it wasn't that I don't have a professional impetus for being here, or a personal impetus for being here, and that, you know, so that's where I see the racism, is like the trying to place me and at the same time displace me out of Maine. And it's an interesting, I'm working through that lens, you know, I'm working through my own lens and recrafting my own lens, where I say, no, I'm here and I belong here. And maybe this is where I spend the rest of my life in Maine. So it's an interesting tension.
I think we're lucky to have you here, because you're thinking of those things and seeing them from a personal perspective. You turn out to be a fabulous advocate for others. And you're working here and concurrently completing your doctorate in education at Cornell. I wonder what your big dream is for your life's work.
Oh, well, I would love to be able to start or facilitate or, you know, be part of a public conversation, a national conversation, international conversation, that is grounded in questions around identity, schooling. So not just learning and not just teaching, but the schooling. And there's a distinction there. So identity, schooling, bilingualism, biculturalism, and what that means in terms of identity formation as an adult. What I mean is, those of us that grew up bilingual, that are bilingual, bicultural, right, and went through a schooling in the United States, how our educational trajectories are impacted by our bicultural, our bilingual dimensions of ourselves and how we learn, and how that compares to the ways in which we're taught, and then how that come together to form us as individual, as adults. So how schooling, bilingual, biculturalism, and adult formation really come together. This is very sort of abstract, but I think that it's a question that doesn't get asked enough. And so it's a conversation that we don't have enough.
Your timing may be very good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nationally and internationally.
Yeah. I mean, bilingual education is a huge field. Learning, teaching, and schooling is a huge field. And adult education and adult sort of identity development is a huge field as well. But the intersection between the three and what kind of adults we become as bilingual, bicultural, and through an American schooling experience that isn't bilingual, that isn't bicultural in many ways. You know, so what does that mean for us and who we become as people?
Mm-hmm. I wish you luck
This
conversation for all
Thank
of our
you.
Sakes. Mariana, you embody your mother's feminist ideals and your father's outreach and activism, and you are a force in your own right. I'm really impressed by the way you have blended your disparate realities in such a lively and authentic way. And thank you so much
for
taking the time to come here today. And for your helping to make this a much more richly diverse community we have here in Maine.
Thank you.
I'm Kate Manahan, in the studio with my guest, Mariana Cruz Gonzalez. Music was a huge part of your upbringing. I'm excited to hear the song you've selected to close today's program. Would you please introduce this song to our listeners?
Sure. This is a song that is written and arranged by my father, Jose Pache Cruz. The song is called Aquí el Cuero Sonó, which means here the skin, the hide, the drum beat sounded. And it's a song that talks about not just Puerto Rico, but the Caribbean history of both slavery and also musical legacies on the island. And so that's what I'll say about the song now, and I look forward to sharing it with all of you.
Great. We'll be dancing here in the studio. Hope you'll join us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Suena en Loíta.